Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. David LaFell. Dr. LaFell is the Deputy Dean for Clinical Affairs at Yale School of Medicine, the David Page Smith Professor of Dermatologic Surgery, and author of the book Total Skin.
David, in past shows, we've discussed the two most common type of skin cancers, namely basal cell and squamous cell cancer. But this evening, we're going to be focusing our discussion on the third type of skin cancer called melanoma. So perhaps we could start off by defining what is melanoma.
Melanoma is a cancer of the pigment cells of the skin. Basal cell cancer and squamous cell cancer arise in the epidermis, or the top layer of the skin. Melanoma, however, arises from the bottom cells of the top layer of the skin, the epidermis. And these are pigment cells that are designed to respond to ultraviolet radiation from the sun. And when they respond to the sun, they lead to the tanning reaction.
So, David, how common is melanoma?
Melanoma is quite common, and unfortunately, its incidence appears to be increasing. I think that there'll be about 70,000 new cases diagnosed this year, and approximately 8,000 people will die from melanoma.
Is the increased incidence of melanoma related at all to the changes in the ozone layer, and to what degree does global warming and all the other things happening in the environment influence the incidence of melanoma?
It's not really clear. It's important to note that not all melanomas are due to ultraviolet radiation from the sun. It's a difficult thing to figure out, but it's estimated that only about 60% of melanomas are probably in some way related to sun exposure. Melanoma can definitely occur where the sun doesn't shine, and we'll talk a little later perhaps about the proper steps with respect to full body skin examination to diagnose melanoma at its earliest treatable stage. We think that lifestyle, probably more than changes in the ozone, have a greater impact on those melanomas that are in some way related to ultraviolet radiation, not just from the sun, but from these tanning parlors as well.
Hmm. And David, is there any age in which you tend to see a higher incidence of melanoma? And also, is there any particular predilection, males versus females?
Well, that's a great question, because recently there was a report that demonstrated that the incidence of melanoma in young women in their 20s and 30s was increasing, and at a greater incidence rate than for individuals, males and females, in other age groups. Typically, melanoma is more common in men over 50, and its increasing incidence in younger women is concerning.
And is the increased incidence in younger women perhaps due to the fact that a lot of these individuals are going to tanning salons and trying to have that wonderful tan?
We don't really know. It's certainly a possibility. Back in the early 90s, the incidence for younger women had leveled off, and then it started taking off again. And, you know, it's difficult to necessarily take a behavior or a social behavior pattern and try to link it definitively to a change in the incidence of any particular cancer, especially when we're dealing with a relatively short period. But the reality is that we know that ultraviolet radiation causes mutations in the skin. We know that it plays an important role in causing basal cell cancer and squamous cell cancer that I mentioned at the outset. And we know that it does play a role in certain melanomas.
So, David, could you talk a little bit about potential genetic connections with melanoma? Does it run in families, for instance?
There are forms of melanoma that are familial, and there are genes that are associated with it. But in the scheme of things, they actually represent the minority of cases. So individuals that have a family history of melanoma are at increased risk for developing the disease and need to be monitored especially closely. There have also been studies recently that have looked at the gene that controls for red hair and light pigmentation. And a variety of complex interpretations suggest that that gene may result in biological events that increase the risk of developing melanoma. So we've always known that red hair, blonde hair were independent risk factors for developing skin cancer. Now there seems to be perhaps a genetic link.
And David, what about, say, darker colored skin, like in African Americans, Hispanics, is there the same level of risk, or perhaps because of their darker skin color, there's a reduced risk for developing melanoma?
Well, there's probably a reduced risk for developing the most common types of melanoma, which are superficial spreading melanoma and nodular melanoma. But people with darker skin actually can be afflicted by a different type of melanoma, and it's a mouthful, so I'll try to get it out correctly. Acral lentiginous melanoma, or ALM. And this is a form of melanoma that develops on the hands and feet and in the nails can be especially concerning.
So, David, there have been conflicting reports in the medical literature and in the lay press about exposure to sunlight and balancing the risk of melanoma with the need for vitamin D. And so can you give us a little bit of guidance about how one would do that? How much sun exposure is enough sun exposure?
Sure. The amount of sun exposure that results in production of vitamin D in the skin, and that's really what you're referring to. It turns out that ultraviolet light will convert cholesterol molecules in your skin to forms of pre-vitamin D. And vitamin D actually isn't a vitamin as we understand it. It's more correctly a hormone, and it's an important hormone. And ultraviolet radiation in our environment can be used to stimulate normal vitamin D production in the skin with as little as 15 minutes twice a week of exposure, say at lunchtime when the sun is high. The real question is, and there's been a lot in the media about this, whether one has to go out of their way to get extra sun exposure to get vitamin D. And one of the issues that's driving this is the recognition now that vitamin D plays a role in certain cancers, perhaps in other diseases of aging. And there's a legitimate question about what normal vitamin D levels should be. The general feeling, though, is that the risk of developing melanoma and other skin cancers probably far outweighs the risk of not developing enough what we call endogenous vitamin D, because it's so easily provided with vitamin supplementation.
So you're generally recommending the use of sunscreens for everybody?
The use of sunscreen with a sun protection factor of 30 and ultraviolet A blocking is recommended for everyone, especially those who are at risk for developing skin cancer.
And David, you know, all of us have these moles on various parts of our skin. When does one need to begin to worry that this mole might in fact be a melanoma?
Well, you're right. You know, the average adult has about 40 moles, and moles are a normal part of the skin, and they represent benign, non-cancerous collections of pigment cells. There is an entity that's referred to as an atypical mole. These are moles that have, if you will, gone sour, and they can be related to the development of melanoma. In some cases, they're actually a red flag, and they tell you to get in to see the doctor. While that particular growth may not be a melanoma, it certainly gets your attention and the attention of your physician. The question about how often one has to be examined really relates to the risk factor. You know, standard recommendations are, you know, after the age of 50, you should have an annual full-body skin examination. But certainly, if you have a family history of melanoma, if you have any of the independent risk factors, such as light hair, red hair that I mentioned before, blue, gray, or green eyes, a single blistering sunburn in childhood, that is, before the age of 18, all of these are factors that put you at increased risk for melanoma, and you should have a complete skin examination as soon as you're aware of the fact that you fall into those risk groups.
David, I'd like to get back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the incidence of melanoma in non-sun-exposed areas. How frequent is this? And I'm sure this is certainly something that people miss because oftentimes we only focus on our arms and our legs. So can you tell us a little bit about that and what we can do to screen for that?
Well, that's an extremely important question because while we talk about the sun and protection against ultraviolet radiation, which is extremely important, somehow in that message, another important point does get lost, and that is not all melanomas occur on sun-exposed areas. So it's essential that you have a full-body skin examination by someone who's trained in doing skin exams, and that they look through the scalp all the way to the bottoms of the feet. And that includes looking between the toes. I think I and many other dermatologists have diagnosed melanomas between the toes, certainly in the scalp. And it can be a challenge for individuals with a full head of hair, something I can't really sympathize with. But you really have to very carefully go through the scalp with a comb or a blow dryer on low and really make sure that you've examined every inch of the scalp. The genital area is important to examine as well. We've certainly seen melanomas in that location. And I think that it's very common for patients to come in and we say, okay, you're here for your full body skin exam. We'll give you a gown. Please change it. No. Just look at my face. I'm sure I don't have anything else. And then we ask the patient whether they're familiar with what they have on their back. And very quickly, they recognize the importance of having a full body skin exam. But, you know, your question's important for another reason, and that is there's a sense that the majority of melanomas are actually first identified by the patient or by the spouse or partner. I can't tell you the number of times that a melanoma patient is sitting in front of me, usually a male, with the girlfriend or wife sitting in the corner, shaking her finger, saying, of course, I told him to come in 6 months ago or whatever. I think that in general, the doctor will do a full skin exam as much for educating you about what to look for as to find worrisome lesions. Worrisome lesions don't develop on a schedule. And patients have a sixth sense when something isn't right. They may not know the biological explanation for what they see, but they know, you know, doc, I just don't like it. And if the patient says that, it gets biopsied, even if I think that it looks normal.
And David, there's a thing called the ABCs, or I guess ABCDs, of worrisome lesions. Maybe you can kind of take us through that?
Well, the A stands for asymmetry. If you imagine the lesion that you're looking at and fold it over in half, if the two halves don't match, then it's asymmetric. B is for border. If there's an irregular or notched or scalloped border, that's a problem. If there's abnormality in color, for example, if you see red and black and brown and white or any combination of two of those, for example, that's an indication, actually, that the body's immune system may actually be having it out with the melanoma cells. And the redness is actually a sign of inflammation, and sometimes the white is a sign that the battle is over and the body has successfully destroyed those abnormal cells. But in other areas of the lesion, it's clear that the melanoma is still there. Diameter is the other factor, and we talk about any lesion that's greater than a pencil eraser or 7 millimeters. But, you know, all of these guidelines came up many years ago, and they're generally very gross. One of the most important criteria that I alluded to before is whether the patient is concerned about the lesion. To me, that says a lot.
So, David, we have to take a break right now. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the biopsy and the procedure for treating patients with melanoma when we come back.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Voss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. David LaFell, the David Page Smith, Professor of Dermatologic Surgery at Yale School of Medicine. We're here today talking about early stage melanoma. So, David, could we open this section by you describing to us how the diagnosis of melanoma is made?
The diagnosis of melanoma is made by a skin biopsy. First, as we talked about in the first segment, the patient or the doctor is concerned about a lesion, and the only way to know what that lesion or growth is to take a sample of it and study it under the microscope. And this is a very straightforward office procedure. First, the area is numbed with local anesthesia, lidocaine, similar to what the dentist might use. And then the specimen of skin is removed. If it's very tiny, the whole growth may be removed in what's called a saucerized biopsy. Or if it's larger than can easily be removed in its entirety, one might take a sample of the melanoma itself. This biopsy is very important for a few reasons. First, it tells you whether or not we're dealing with a melanoma as opposed to a benign growth or just an atypical or abnormal mole. Secondly, it gives you information about various aspects of the melanoma under the microscope, perhaps the most important of which is how thick the melanoma is. This is important because the thickness of a melanoma is the single most important factor that determines the prognosis, in other words, how well you're going to do. You know, the melanoma diagnosis that we've been talking about today is extremely important because the vast majority of melanomas are diagnosed at the earliest highly treatable stage, probably more than 90%. When we hear about melanoma and the seriousness of the condition, it really relates to those cases that are more advanced that may have been thicker at the time of diagnosis. But melanoma that's up to 1 millimeter in thickness at the time of diagnosis is easily treated simply by going back and having an office-based surgical procedure that removes the melanoma and a margin of tissue around it.
And David, who would be the person to do this biopsy? Would it be a general dermatologist, or would it be someone like yourself who specializes in dermatologic surgical procedures?
Skin biopsies, including skin biopsies for melanoma, are routinely done by dermatologists, by plastic surgeons, and certainly by general surgeons. Anyone who is trained in the proper techniques and is comfortable in terms of making the clinical diagnosis so that they know what kind of biopsy to do should be very comfortable performing a melanoma biopsy. The question after that is, once you have the diagnosis, the type of referral you should have for proper management of the melanoma.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do with a patient who has a very early stage melanoma, and in contrast, what you would do with a patient who has one of the more deeper, more advanced melanomas?
Well, as I mentioned, the most important factor is the depth of the lesion. There are other factors as well that help you determine whether it's a high-risk lesion or a low-risk lesion. If it's a very low-risk lesion, and that includes an assessment of where on the body the growth is occurring, simple removal with 1 centimeter margins, for example, a third of an inch or more, is sufficient to result in the maximal cure rate. However, increasingly, when we're dealing with higher risk lesions, even within the category less than a millimeter, we may consider doing a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And that's a procedure where one identifies what lymph nodes that particular area drains to, and in a operating room, the sentinel lymph node or the gatekeeper lymph node is sampled to determine whether melanoma has spread there or not. When you do that procedure and you find that that lymph node is negative for cancer, that provides great prognostic information. It doesn't necessarily have an impact on how well the patient is going to do, but it certainly helps guide an assessment of what other therapies might have to be provided. With more advanced melanomas, the sentinel lymph node biopsy becomes almost routine. And with extremely advanced melanomas, in other words, in melanomas where it has already spread to the lymph nodes, there's obviously no need to do a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And These are complex issues. There's a huge amount of data emerging about the value of the sentinel lymph node biopsy. And the Yale Cancer Center surgeons, Dr. Steve Arian, Dr. Deepak Narayan, are very skilled in performing this procedure and managing the surgical aspects of advanced melanoma.
And so, David, if the sentinel lymph node biopsy comes out negative, does that mean then that there's no risk for the melanoma having spread to the regional lymph nodes?
No, it doesn't. And there are large population studies that are looking at the significance of a negative sentinel lymph node. There's even a procedure where, unsatisfied with looking at the cells under the microscope, we actually look at fragments of DNA to see if we can find fragments of DNA of the melanoma. It's an evolving area. And I think one of the reasons it's so important for research to go on in this area as it does is because, as we mentioned at the outset, melanoma affects a lot of young people. And we don't really know where this trend is going to go. And importantly, if it's diagnosed early, you know, it's virtually curable. And so the opportunity to do self-skin exams, full-body skin exams, to be appropriately suspicious of lesions that you develop can be life-saving.
So, David, is there anything easy like a simple blood test or a molecular test that can be done on the blood that would help us to know which melanoma patients have distant disease? Has that been developed yet?
That really has not been developed and is certainly not in general use.
And that gets me to my next point, which is that the Yale Cancer Center actually has received a skin spore from the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, and is doing a lot of research related to skin diseases. Can you tell us a little bit about what they're doing with respect to melanoma?
That's right. The spore actually covers a study on basal cell cancer in young people that I'm directly involved with. But in the area of melanoma, there's a variety of efforts looking at tumor markers and means of identifying antigens or other proteins in the blood that will help not only identify whether melanoma is present systemically in the system, but also provide an opportunity for tracking progress.
David, for patients with early stage melanoma, and as you say, the vast majority really are potentially curable once the skin lesion has been removed, is there any other treatment that needs to be done once that melanoma lesion has been removed by the surgeon?
Generally, no. For early stage melanoma, there are cases where you're at the interface between low risk and medium risk, and there's questions about the use of interferon. But even the use of interferon itself has really not held out consistently in the literature. And, you know, it highlights the point that treatment of early melanoma is relatively easy. And the only limitation to treating early melanoma is making the diagnosis.
How often do patients who have already had a melanoma develop a recurrence or a different melanoma?
The chance of developing a second primary melanoma, in other words, another melanoma different than the one that was originally diagnosed, is probably about 6%, and therefore it's very important for those patients to be monitored. The risk of developing a recurrent melanoma, in other words, the chances of the melanoma that was treated, the chances of it coming back, really vary with the type of melanoma and how it was treated.
And David, how frequently should these individuals be followed up by their dermatologist to make sure that there's no recurrence of the melanoma?
So a person that has a single melanoma identified should be followed, and the protocols vary, but our routine in the cutaneous oncology unit at Yale is to follow people every 4 months for the first year, and then you can go back to twice a year after that. But as Francine implied before, these patients are at increased risk for developing second melanomas. So careful monitoring of them is extremely important. And some of these patients, you know, have lesions that look very innocuous and then turn out to be melanomas. So you really have to get to know your patient's skin just as the patient needs to get to know her own skin.
Is there any role for CAT scans or PET scanning as you follow these patients who have already had a melanoma?
Not for early stage melanoma.
And David, what are your general recommendations for sun exposure and the use of sunscreen, sunblocks, once the melanoma has been removed?
Patients need to be very vigilant about sun protection, even if their melanoma developed in a non-sun-exposed area, because that suggests to me that from a genetic point of view, their body has the capability of making a melanoma, and maybe for the non-sun-exposed melanoma that they had, the stimulus was not the sun, but the sun could equally act as a stimulus, a second hit almost, for someone who is predisposed. So the sun protection programs include using a sunscreen with a sun protection factor of 30 with ultraviolet A block, because remember, SPF just refers to ultraviolet B block. They should wear a brimmed hat. You know, everyone thinks that a baseball cap does a trick. I can't tell you the number of melanomas that I've seen on the tips of the ears. So you need to wear a brimmed hat. You need to avoid the sun. And this sounds like, you know, makes me a killjoy, but the peak hours between 10 and 4 where the sun is strongest, if you find a way to have your leisure activity outdoors before 10 o'clock and after 4, you'll probably get an easier time getting a tea time. The marina won't be as busy. The tennis court won't be as busy. And you'll be protecting your skin.
So, David, my 12-year-old tries to tell me that on cloudy days, he doesn't need to wear his sunscreen. Can you clarify for our listeners, you know, whether or not you need the sunscreen on a cloudy day?
Well, I'm pleased to tell you on public radio that you are right. And he is wrong. The ultraviolet radiation does penetrate haze and clouds, and people get sunburned. So you could be out at baseball practice, it's a hazy day, and they think they don't need a sunscreen, and they come in to see me Monday morning with, you know, a full-blown pink sunburned face.
Well, obviously, the recommendation to avoid sun exposure is particularly relevant now that we're in the summer months presently.
There's one other question I wanted to ask David earlier, and that is the issue of the non-pigmented melanoma. I know that's relatively rare. Can you just tell us how often that occurs?
Yeah, everything we've talked about from the outset, when I talked about the melanocyte, the pigment-producing cell, and how when it goes abnormal, it becomes a cancer, and the cancer is known as melanoma, all of that really relates to irregularly pigmented or dark growths, which I think many people can have in their mind's eye. One of the most worrisome things for dermatologists, especially dermatologists that have been in practice for a long time, is something called amelanotic melanoma. And an amelanotic melanoma is a melanoma without pigment. And if you think about it, and if you look at your arm or the back of your hand or your leg, I think you'll all see that you may have flesh-colored growths that are not concerning, and you'd have no way to really consider that they would be something to worry about. I'm not suggesting that you should start worrying about them, but amelanotic melanoma are lesions that dermatologists can often be suspicious of, and the patient too. The patient, as I mentioned a couple of times, might come in and say that they don't like the appearance of it. In a red-haired, very fair-skinned individual, it may be reddish in appearance. It may be like a little dome-shaped papule, but it can have other appearances as well. And I think it highlights the need for very careful examination by a dermatologist.
David, there's also this entity called ocular melanoma. And is there any relationship between the development of ocular melanoma and sun exposure?
The ocular melanoma is a type of malignancy that develops on the retina. And the relationship between that and ultraviolet radiation, I don't believe is as strong as the relationship between ultraviolet radiation and cutaneous melanoma. It's a good point that you make, and that when people have, you know, their routine eye exam, they need to make sure that they're getting a comprehensive eye exam, because that's the only way it can be diagnosed.
Any research ongoing to try to identify agents that might be able to help prevent the recurrence of melanoma, or really the key is to try to minimize, avoid sun exposure?
I think the one area that we didn't really have much time to talk about, but that is quite special with respect to melanoma, is its relationship with the immune system. For a variety of reasons, melanoma cells are either exquisitely sensitive to aspects of the immune system or very clever in evading it. And it's that unique interface with the immune system that has raised the possibility on an ongoing basis of developing a melanoma vaccine. A year doesn't go by that you don't hear about a new melanoma vaccine. Now, the fact that every year you hear about a new melanoma vaccine tells you how challenging it is to develop a means to harness the body's own immune system to fight melanoma. But we'll get there.
Great. Well, David, thanks so much for being with us on the show this evening, and we look forward to having you come back and talk about the different types of skin cancer.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our special guest, Dr. David LaFell, for another terrific program. Please join us again next Sunday evening. Until then, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.